back. It's episode 75 of the Flagstick.com Tea Talk podcast. This episode is brought to you by TaylorMade and the all-new Sim Driver. Scott McLeod here, the associate publisher of Flagstick Golf Magazine and a PGA of Canada professional. My co-host, Stefan Tiedorf, is absent this week. He's at his cottage enjoying some time off, much needed. He'll be back next week, and then we can get back to a regular show. This one's going to be a little shorter this week. Obviously, he's not here, so we can't debate back and forth and have any big discussions about a lot of topics that are happening out there, and I really don't want to bore you with my own droning about my own opinion on particular things, so we'll just get right to it. We have a great guest this week. Ralph Bauer is a PGA of Canada professional. He's also a PGA Tour coach that works with a number of players, a number of PGA Tour winners, by his recollection, having won $160 million or so on the PGA Tour. Fantastic guy, and I think you'll really appreciate his insight in this interview. Just a couple of quick things just to mention. Obviously, a lot of people watched Jon Rahm's win at Muirfield Village, a much different golf course than Colin Morikawa won at with the Workday Charity Open. Tough conditions. Got a big lead there. It was quite entertaining, especially to watch how spectators were seeing this golf course play out almost like a U.S. Open. It was super, super tough. Interesting situations, obviously, with players like Rahm now obviously getting a win and going to number one in the world. So that's obviously causing a lot of discussion and people wondering, is he valid? Is he the number one? Is he the best player in the world? He's obviously there from a point standpoint, but is he the best player in the world? I'm sure a lot of you are thinking about that and discussing it, whether it be on social media or within your golf friends. Other things from the weekend, interesting things with Phil Mickelson playing Muirfield Village, whether he was making a mockery of the golf course or not, laying up on a par three, he had his drink cup out on a putt, he just doing a number of different things out there, but that's obviously lots of discussion as well. Bryson missing the cut, a lot of talk about him in the last few weeks on the show, but blew it all out there on one hole, just smashing a fairway wood over and over again, couple of them out of bounds. We'll see how he rebounds from that, especially as we head towards major season as well. A couple other notes from the weekend. Taylor Pendrith, Canadian, continuing to do well. Another second place finish, another top three finish on the Korn Ferry Tour. He is on such a heater right now. It's amazing to watch. Climbing the world rankings very quickly. And look out for this guy. He's definitely got an opportunity to get, you know, up there, maybe even the top 100, even without being on the PGA Tour. He's playing that well. I would look for him to have a victory soon as well. Last week, we talked a little bit about Gary Player revealing on our show that Jack Nicklaus and Barbara Nicklaus had COVID-19. Jack Nicklaus officially declared that, discussed it on the CBS broadcast, which brought us a lot of attention. I will say that. I had a lot of DMs, a lot of discussions with some different people. Maybe they didn't realize that Mr. Player had made those comments on our podcast back on May 14th. But obviously we knew about Mr. Nicklaus having COVID-19 way far back when. We didn't make any comments of it. We didn't make a really big deal of it because we didn't have any other confirmation about it. But it certainly was interesting when he came out and talked about that. Last thing I note before we get to the interview, we are a podcast based in Canada, and I would certainly be remiss if I didn't discuss this week the Golf Journalists Association of Canada, which I'm part of the board for. That we have our annual awards that are coming in right now. So if you want to go on the our Twitter page for the association, it's at GJ_AC. You're going to see a link there to a lot of the awards being presented this week. Lots of great writing, lots of great multimedia photography. I would encourage a lot of people to go and check that out and maybe learn a little bit more about the people that are covering the game of golf, especially in Canada as well. All right, that said, let's get on to it. Our feature interview this week, as I mentioned, Ralph Bauer, basically a great golf coach. I think you'll really enjoy this discussion, not only about coaching out on tour, but also, you know, coming up as a golf professional, things he does with players, things that are different with tour players versus the average player for a coach. And then also as well, so a little bit about retaining golfers and why it's important. And he's got some great insight, and I think you'll really appreciate this interview. This episode of T-Talk is brought to you by TaylorMade and the all-new Sim Driver. This year, TaylorMade wanted to find golfers more speed and forgiveness in any way, shape, or form. Well, shape one. So they went and changed the driver head, which allowed them to make it both fast and forgiving where you need it, the downswing. It's called Sim, and TaylorMade's tour players are loving it. But the real reason they changed the shape was to help make all golfers better. The all-new Sim Driver. Visit TaylorMadeGolf.ca to learn more about the all-new Sim family. All right, we'd like to welcome to the podcast award-winning coach Ralph Bauer, Canadian. Not everybody is familiar with Ralph, although I think they should be. He's not a guy who really draws a lot of attention to himself, but we'll have a good chat today, I'm sure, about golf and golf coaching in general. Welcome to the podcast, Ralph.
Scott, thanks for having me on. Looking forward to it, buddy.
You're obviously at home right now. You're just coming off a stint of going out and being on the PGA Tour. But before we get to the PGA Tour stuff, how does a guy from Turkey Point, Ontario, get all the way up to working on the PGA Tour? I'm sure it's a story you've shared before, but certainly our listeners would definitely like to hear it.
Well, you know, we had a guy from Turkey Point coach in the NHL. So, I mean, why not do this, right?
Sure.
But obviously, I grew up in a small town, right? And, just kind of kept playing golf, fell in love with it. I was lucky I had the small little golf course, didn't have a range or anything, but always had a CPGA professional, right, who kind of, instilled the love of the game for me, in me, which, has never left. And, I went to school in the States on a golf scholarship and all that. And, I was lucky enough to play on a powerhouse golf team. We had the second ranked team in the country at one point.
Was that UTEP?
UTEP, yeah. So, I got to play with kind of all the best players in the world at that, college players, Mickelson, Furyk, those guys. And I got to also see people who were, very good who didn't make it, right? And then, when I didn't make it, I thought, hey, let's, what's the difference between those guys that did and the guys that didn't? And back then, coaching really wasn't really an avenue to get better, I would say. Like, people either were good or they weren't, right? So I thought, hey, well, maybe I'll try to become a coach that, could help some of those people who maybe weren't good enough, on their own to make it and to, find out at least how good they could be. So I've been doing this full time since about 2001.
Wow.
Been, time flies. But it's been full time in the PGA Tour since, 2009. Like, some of the events I've been to 12 times now, which is kind of weird, but some of the grocery stores out there, I know where the what day they're putting their tomatoes on special.
No, the one thing I've always liked about you, and I appreciated a lot, was when I've seen you out on tour, you don't draw a lot of attention to yourself. You always have, I think sometimes, you've got your big hat on, you've got your sunglasses. I can remember walking by you at the range at Riviera and not even knowing it was you. What is it like to be out there? And obviously it's become a bit of a circus, a little bit of a show for a lot of people. You see a lot of people working on the range and they're really trying to bring attention to themselves, but you're always focused on your player and that's always your intention. And I respect that a lot. Is that just part of your philosophy or is that just, is it just what you do?
Yeah. I made a decision when I got into this to always put the athlete's interests first. I just thought, that just seemed like a logical thing to do. And I always felt like, hey, if I put their interests first and they were getting better, then that's all I could really do. Right.
Yeah.
And in terms of, somebody told me Dave Woods, I don't know if you know Dave Woods. He's great coach or something. Then he told me a long time ago, I'll never forget. It's like, Ralph, if you got into coaching for a pat on the back, you got the wrong business, right? So, I do have some friends, some coaches out there, and I make sure to congratulate them when one of their players had a good week or, when one of their players is noticeably getting better. And, it's nice to hear, get the odd text from, some of your colleagues to say, hey, good job, Ralph, with that or this or that, but it doesn't happen often for sure.
I mean, for you as well, getting to the PGA Tour was obviously a big step. And I think that story has been told a little bit about how you, developed and worked with some players from very early on. David Hearn would be an example, and then obviously got out there on tour. But, we started out working as a PGA member, as a coach, you obviously worked with Team Ontario. You were an Ontario PGA Award winner, worked with Team Canada as well. When did it sort of become a thought for you to kind of go from, you know, just working with, and I shouldn't say just because it's just as important, if not more, as far as player development is concerned, but working with players at a club level to all of a sudden working with tour players?
Yeah, well, first of all, I'll just, you know, that just word, like I was told this a long time ago. I think it's true. I feel like our best coaches should be working with our youngest players, right? Like, I think it's just super important at a young age to have quality coaching. And I'm lucky I'm in a position now where I can give back a little bit. And I mean, yesterday I had a coach, you know, send me some videos saying, hey, like, I've got these young players, super talented. What direction should their swing go? You know, I was happy to send them back, send the coach back some, you know, some, you know, my thoughts, whether they were right or wrong. Right. But yeah, I think, you know, they should, you know, maybe go in this direction. And I just think it's super important to do a great job with, you know, young players. And, you know, because the earlier you can impact them with good habits, and, you know, then, you know, that the exponential improvement in their game that's going to make, right? Yeah. So I feel like that's, you know, I had a player who a couple weeks ago was playing in a provincial championship, a junior, and they were playing brutal the whole practice rounds. They kept sending me video, and I was at a tour event, and I was losing sleep over this kid who's playing in the, you know, Alberta Junior.
Yeah.
Right. And of course, then he comes in second, doesn't send me any text messages that he turned his game around or anything. Just sends me a picture with him with the runner up trophy. I was like, well, geez, you know, could have, I slept better that night. But yeah, I think it's super important to do a great job with juniors and take their game seriously. And, you know, can't stress that enough. I think it's really important as a coach to do as good a job as you can with whoever's in front of you. Right. Mm-hmm. And
good point.
You know, it really doesn't matter. You know, I've worked with a bunch of guys on tour, obviously. And one of them, Nick Taylor, I worked with Nick Taylor for 4 or 5 years, and or maybe 4 years, but he used to phrase it in nice ways. Like, Ralph, if you were teaching a junior at home, how would you teach him to hit this shot? Right. Which is, yeah, always kind of put my mind at ease. I'm like, well, I would teach him how to do it this way. He's like, Okay, well, let's do that then. Right. So, yeah, I just can't stress enough how important it is to work with, to do a great job with whoever, you know, whoever trusts you with their golf game. You know, even the recreational player, you think about it, recreational player, you know, people only have so much leisure time, right? Mm-hmm. And their golf is going to be very important to them, right? Like, that's how they've chosen to spend their leisure time. And you're helping them out with that to enjoy it more. And I just feel like it's, you know, super important to do a good job with that, right? So,
yeah.
I think you're, and I apologize, I forget the gist of the original question. I got off my junior.
No, that's okay. It's just, you know, in talking about, you know,
somebody one time asked me what my goals were.
Yeah.
And I said, oh, I want to coach tour players. And I dawned on me, I'm like, what am I even talking about? I thought the only way I'm going to be able to do that is if I create a PGA tour. Like, nobody's going to call you.
Right.
If you're out of range and you're doing a great job, no tour player is going to call you. So you have to create a tour player, and then you're a PGA Tour coach. You can't just go out there and hand out business cards, you know. Or I guess nowadays, though, you can go on Instagram, do a bunch of stuff on Instagram, and people will call you, you know, which seems crazy, but, you know, that's a thing. Right.
Golfers are crazy, right? So, I mean, that's just the way it is. Enough. I mean,
you know, they're lonely. They're in a hotel room. They're looking for help. They're scrolling through Instagram.
They are desperate sometimes. Yeah, I get it. Just, you know, relative to that, you were discussing kind of the differences between, you know, kind of club golfers, emerging juniors, that sort of thing, and tour players. I don't think a lot of people really understand sort of the differences of and what differences, if any, there are of working with tour players versus the emerging players. Obviously, they're different at where they're at in the stage of their development. But, you know, what is it that you're doing more out there with those players versus the, you know, a developing player? Maybe you want to explain that a little bit to the listener.
Yeah, that's a good question. I wish I had a better answer, but there's not much difference. A session out on the range on tour event is going to look shockingly similar to a session at home with a young player, right? Yeah. So it's just shockingly similar. You know, we all have the same issues. You know, our ball position gets a little too far forward. Maybe our ball position gets a little too far back because we're playing in the wind, you know, and then our, you know, takeaway gets messed up as a result of that. Or, you know, we all have the same issues. And they're, I guess the one of the main differences, they're typically so good, you have to jump in a little quicker with the when you see a problem, because it might not have manifested itself yet in a poor outcome, but it's going to. You know, they can kind of mask their mistakes for a few weeks, and you know, it's kind of important as a coach to catch them before they, you know, become unmasked, I guess would be a way of putting it. But no, it's super similar. Shocking.
So when I mean, that's true. I mean, I understand that. I just don't think most of the listeners and things do. But even when you're working with those players, let's say for an example, you know, you're actually out on tour versus at home with them and doing some different things. I mean, here's a lesson maybe a little bit for the home golfer who is all of a sudden in the middle of their competitive golf season and they're trying to make big changes in their golf game. I mean, are you making big changes when these players are in a competitive cycle, or are you saving that obviously for when they're away from the golf course, or are you forced into that situation sometimes because maybe they have something going really bad?
Yeah, you know, I mean, in a perfect world, you don't want to do that, you know, during the off season, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes you are forced into that, and you know, if something's going bad, you have to change it. I mean, you can't just keep going. You know, if they don't have the control of their golf ball, you have to change something to get them to control the golf ball. A quick story, I had a player a few weeks ago who was struggling. We made a pretty drastic change to their golf swing Saturday night, right? And they ended up coming, you know, playing great Sunday and having top five, right? So,
nice.
I mean, it happens. It's not something at the start of the week, I thought, hey, you know what I'll do? I'll just kind of wait until Saturday night and make a change to their golf swing and move on. But, you know, sometimes you have to do what you got to do. You know, it's no different than, you know, if you're coaching NHL, I'm assuming, you know, third period rolls around and, you know, whatever you were doing is not working. I mean, you gotta make some changes, right?
Yeah. So then when, you know, in working with these players as well, I mean, you're a coach. I mean, that's a big thing. And there's a different word there between instruction. And you mentioned early on about, you know, maybe the quality of we'll call it coaching. We'll say the quality of how people were doing self-improvement years ago, but maybe address a little bit the evolution of the coaching model versus just the instruction model and how some things have changed over the years regarding that.
Yeah, I feel like that's, you know, I feel like Canada's actually done a really good job with that, where we've got a lot of what I would call coaches, or people that, you know, are able to kind of take a holistic approach to improving your golf game, whether that's, you know, maybe a better warm up, maybe a better stretching, maybe, you know, better course management, you know, whatever. So I feel like Canada's got a lot of good young coaches who are able to help players improve their, you know, their score, you know, on the golf course. So I feel like Canada's done a great job of that. Whereas, you know, maybe 20 years ago, we didn't have very many. I was lucky, but 20 years ago, we only had a few and I was one of them. Right. So it was kind of easy to break into the market because, you know, it was super rare to see a coach at a, let's say at a junior event, sure, or an amateur event. There'd only be two or three of us there. And, you know, now there's quite a few, which has been great. But, you know, I just feel like Canada's done a pretty good job of, you know, growing quite a few coaches that are really good. They're really good.
So do you think that's part of the reasoning now why we're seeing the overall success? And when I say success, I mean, you know, I'll judge it based on just, you know, wins and presence in the top levels of the game, be it the female game or the men's game. But, you know, there's lots of ways to judge that, obviously, as far as what you consider success out there. But do you think because we have that proliferation of coaching, do you think that's a big factor that's part of that success right now?
I mean, yeah, it's a big factor. I mean, the guys who are playing great are, you know, right around 29 to 30, you know, the four guys who, you know, like, you know, with, you know, Roger and Adam and Mac and Corey and, right, like Nick. But those guys are more like 30.
Yeah.
Right. And I've been thinking kind of more like guy, you know, there's been a lot of great strides with coaching in the last 5-10 years. Right. And yeah, I just think that, you know, there's a lot of good coaches out there who are working hard and trying the best they can to, you know, help improve players for sure.
Now, one thing I always liked about you as well is that you always seem to be doing work on your own game. Again, it's from a holistic approach. I always see you kind of working on your fitness. You're exploring a lot of different things. How do you think that helps you from a development-wise of being somebody who's always learning, always trying to get better? How does that help you as a coach with your players?
Yeah, I think it's important for a coach to continue golf. And for, like, I don't want to ever ask any of my players to do things that I won't do, right? So if I'm telling them, hey, you got to go to the gym and you have to watch what you eat and you have to sleep well, I think that's ludicrous. If I'm not doing that, and then I ask them to do that, then why would they listen to me on anything?
Yeah.
Right. So I also think it's important for me to golf. So if I, you know, miss the odd 6-foot left to right putt, I can realize, hey, those are pretty hard. Right. And not, you know, get too stressed, you know, not, you know, be able to, you know, talk to a player intelligently about, you know, kind of the trials and tribulations of golf. Right. But, you know, I just think it's super important as a coach. Not every coach does that, and that's fine with them. They're fine with me, right? But yeah. I know for me, I feel it's important that I can, you know, work on my game, work on my fitness, you know, do those things. I do a lot of testing on myself too. Like if I'm like I, you know, the players always go to Malaysia, right? So I went to Malaysia 1 year to see what, you know, humidity. It's like 110 degrees over there.
Right.
You know, 100% humidity. I want to see what that did to your body. I want to see what traveling there and living there for a week would do to your body, right? I want to see, hey, flying from West Coast to East Coast, you know, and then performing the next day, you know, what should you be ingesting on the plane? Like a lot of little things that I feel like, yeah, it's one thing if I just read them and then tell the players, hey, I read this, here's what you should do.
Sure.
I feel like comes from a, you know, bit more authenticity if I've actually, you know, done that. So yeah, I just think it's super important. It's not for everybody, but you know, I just feel like it's super important.
So what for you? I mean, you said you've been doing this now since 2001, so we've got 20 years in, but you know, that's a big change, especially in golf. I mean, things have changed a lot incrementally in short periods of time in golf. What do you think the biggest difference has been, especially in the last 4 or 5 years, as far as tools, technology, knowledge? Is there a particular aspect of it you think that really has helped the game more than anything?
That's a good question. I feel like I love launch monitors. I've got a quad that I'm, you know, a big fan of.
Yep.
I feel like, you know, it's great for certain things. I feel like, you know, we need to make sure that we're using them appropriately and, you know, we don't just over rely on those. I think technology is cool. I think people would be shocked how rarely PGA Tour players use technology. You know, they just don't use it very much. That's not the first thing they go to. The first thing they go to is ball flight and how can they control the golf ball and then what it looks like on their phone. Right. And I feel like, I do think though that, you know, because there's so many coaches, you know, certainly so many coaches in Canada, I would hate to see coaches have like an arms race where they're trying to shove all this technology on young players. I still think, you know, a great training aid is an alignment stick, big bucket of balls and some water, you know, to drink, right? Like,
yeah, for sure.
Like I feel like, you know, I just don't want kids to think that, you know, all this technology can bypass, you know, all that hard work that they need to put in.
And obviously the technology doesn't do the coaching, right?
No, it doesn't do the coaching. I found what's helped me with the quad for sure is that I can, if I'm trying to prove to a player that they're better, it's very easy for me to do that. And so look, like I'm telling you it's better. Yeah. Ball flight looks better. But I mean, these numbers aren't, I didn't make these numbers up. You can see the screen, you know, you're better, right?
Yes. So it's a validation. Like, yeah. It becomes a validation tool in quantifying things more than anything.
Yeah. So that part is great. But I mean, it's like anything, like, you know, I guess a hammer can do a great job, but you can build a house that, but probably smash a window with it too, I guess. But you know, that's a dumb analogy. Sorry about that.
No, no, I like that one. I mean, it's true. I mean, they're just tools, right? Yeah. On that same aspect in coaching, I know you've been involved a little bit more in doing some stuff online. You obviously do some work with some of your students that way because, you know, we have the option to work remotely now with students. But where is that in your realm of tools and how you make use of it?
Yeah, so it's fun for me to do that. You know, I kind of always thought about doing it, but then during the initial quarantine or whatever, I had some more time on my hands, obviously. And I kind of, to be honest with you, I kind of thought, oh, you know, I'm a decent coach. You know, this online stuff will be pretty easy for me to do. And, you know, there's a bit of a learning curve with it for sure as well.
Yeah.
Right. And I kind of hit on a pretty good formula for it, I guess, where I do a combination of, you know, lessons back and forth, like videos back and forth. And also I find FaceTime super helpful, mm-hmm. right? So just scheduling, because videos back and forth, you know, the better you can communicate, the more, you know, the results just come quicker. And, you know, a 15-minute, you know, FaceTime chat, watching somebody hit golf balls, especially just after I've seen it and sent video. So if a player can send me video, right, I can look at it, analyze it, and then watch him hit balls for 15 minutes and talk to him.
Yeah,
that seems to go over, you know, really well. So that's the part that I kind of like, and I hate turning people down. And this way, I kind of able to work with players from, you know, kind of all over, and you know, it's a lot easier time wise too for me to make, you know, make a commitment to players if, you know, I don't have to. You know, it's just harder to schedule things in person nowadays.
You know, we talk about online. Online also means leaderboard sometimes too. Are you a leaderboard watcher as a coach, or are you somebody who just sort of, you know, they're out doing their thing and maybe you wait for the call, or are you a guy that's always checking to see how they're making out?
Well, right now I'm freaking out because I haven't checked leaderboard in half hour.
But, that's probably why we delayed a little bit to start. You're probably checking on somebody, weren't you?
You know, I feel like I'm a big stat guy.
Okay.
So yeah. I have like a proprietary stat program that I use, and I love stats. I feel pretty confident that all my players know they can call me after the round and ask me what I thought about, you know, cause I'll check the wind. I'll check the thing is, you know, I'll watch Shot Tracker and the new one's great, even better cause it's got ball speed and stuff, but you know, it's pretty easy for them to call me afterwards, and I'll know if they missed it right. Let's say, you know, that three of those holes were on left, right wind, you know, and maybe what we should work on after that. So yeah, I'm pretty into watching stats and watching golf for sure.
And does that help you then if you're on the grounds? I mean, you're a guy, because you look at everything holistically and you want that feedback, obviously your preference is to be there versus to be home sometimes, right?
Yeah, I mean, obviously my first preference would be to be home, but the no, I feel like you need to be on the golf course, you know, and you need to see the conditions the players are competing in. And I mean, at that level, like if somebody's a plus one or plus two handicap, I feel like we can kind of improve their golf games, you know, on the range and in practice. If they're like a plus seven handicap and we're trying to, you know, get them better or trying to get them to play well that week, you know, it's a lot easier for there, that's for sure.
Yeah. Now, as I mentioned earlier, you're coming off a pretty long stint on tour, 50 days. Was that it? Around
yeah.
That? So you made a choice, obviously, to go down there and do that. And obviously, with the way the quarantine works, you know, it wasn't as easy just to pop down there, come back, quarantine, and go back down there. What are your plans as you look forward ahead? I mean, I think you've got a little bit more time now to finish out this quarantine. But, you know, how fast do you think you're going to be back out on the tour?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So, I had to quarantine for 2 weeks in the States before Colonial, which seems crazy that I had to go into the United States to quarantine to
yeah,
to be safe. But that's what I had to do. And then I went to 5 events.
Okay.
And then I came home, and now I'm, you know, quarantined at home now. So it's gonna be like, really, it's gonna be like 64 days before I, you know, can have supper with my family, which is, you know, pretty extended period of time.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm hoping to take 3 weeks here, you know, and then go back to the playoffs. But, you know, if I might go back for Wyndham, I don't know. Like, I try not to think about too much, to be honest with you. It's a bit of a challenge. Like, I decided to do that, but just things are so much more complicated. Like, traveling is so much harder now. Like, right. I would go once a week to get groceries. I would, you know, rent a place with a fridge and stove, go once a week, you know, go to the, stay at my cinema, you know, I'd 50 nights in a row, you know, having dinner by myself in my hotel room, which isn't as glamorous as people think, right? And then I'd go to the golf course, which was great because we were all tested. So felt pretty safe there. And I wore a mask 100%, you know, 100% of the time. Got made fun of for doing it, but, you know, whatever. It's just a lot. And, you know, for the players, though, players used to traveling with their families, right? And now they can't travel with their families, right? So they're on the road. They're having supper by themselves in a hotel room. You know, the only normal part's the golf course, right? And also felt like, hey, like, we're all in this together. You know, they're making sacrifices. A lot of people are. I mean, I'm lucky to have a job. I mean, I have a job, which is great. Yeah. I mean, March, I mean, who knew what was going on, right? So I'm not complaining. I, you know, super pumped to be able to do what I do for a living. And I was gone for a long time, but it also gave me a bigger insight. It's nice to see tournaments from Monday to Sunday, which I don't normally get to do, especially, you know, week after week. So you can be like, okay, well, you know, I'll watch warm up Sunday and then talk to them afterwards. Like, hey, they're practicing more because their families aren't out there. So Monday's like, okay, after we get tested, you know, let's go work on your wedges a little bit. That part was great. You know what I mean? So
just a little bit more immersive, basically.
Yeah, for sure. Like, fully immersive, I guess.
Yeah. Anything else that you found unusual about, you know, the bubble? Obviously, as you said, pretty complicated, you know, difference as far as the travel, hotels, all sorts of different things. But, you know, otherwise, as you said, once you get to the course, everything seems sort of all right, except for no spectators, obviously. But you're not used to that because you're usually not there too much during tournament days.
Yeah, no, I'm normally there till Friday. Okay. Right? I'll watch Thursday, usually parts of Friday, and then take off. But just super weird. Right. And the whole thing was super weird. And, you know, we were in Texas to start with, which, you know, was a bit of a hot spot. And then we're in South Carolina, which is a bit of a hot spot. And, you know, it was just super weird. Right. But
was it like your radar was going off the whole time? You're kind of wary of what's going on all the time and looking over your shoulder or?
Yeah. So I would just go to, I'd go to the grocery store once a week, okay. You know, load up, you know, and so it's not like I ever went to a restaurant or anything, but you drive by these restaurants and everybody's, you know, carrying on with life. Wow. Like, okay, well, that's cool, right? But no, it's just weird, but that's the way it goes. But anyways, glad to be home for a little bit, that's for sure.
Okay, one last question for you. I mean, we talked a little bit about the state of the game as regards to, you know, kind of professional players and stuff like that. Mentioned a little bit about the amateurs and so forth. But where do you think overall the game is in Canada, female, male level, development, health of it overall? I mean, you know, you're an insightful guy. You've been doing this for a while. You've got your own perspective on it. What's your take on it?
Yeah, so I mean, I think we need to continue or start doing a better job of, you know, acquiring new golfers and then keeping them. I don't know if you knew this. I used to operate a golf course, right? So,
yep.
You know, and first thing I did is Marlene Stewart Street from the 100-yard marker. I was like, wow, that's genius. So with my kids, I started them from there. They didn't really want to do it. So I don't know if you've ever been to a Kelsey's restaurant.
Oh yeah,
right.
They had this
treasure box after that the kids can go to and they get these little dollars, you know, cheap toys. So I ended up making a princess and pirate tees at the 100-yard marker.
Okay.
And you know, so if a kid played, they could start from the 100-yard marker, and you know, and then they get a little toy afterwards, right? So they play with their parents, whatever, and their mom or dad. And, you know, so it costs $5. They'd go play golf from the 100-yard marker. The parents loved it because trying to get a young child into the game and they're playing the same tees as you is not fun.
No.
It's not good. No. You know, this way the mom or dad can chop it up a couple times before they get to the 100-yard marker. But I used to tell my kids, like, hey, do you want to go golfing? The answer was always no.
Yeah.
So I'd say, hey, do you want to go play Princess and Pirates? You know, the answer was, yeah, let's go. Right? So I just think there's little things operators can do to, you know, it's easy to say Golf Canada or PGA, but really, I think feel like it boils down to golf operators, right? To make, you know, and not every facility is designed for that. Like, you know, you wouldn't expect, you know, it's not like the private clubs are able to do that, but you know, the public facilities, you know, should, I mean, it's in their best interest. You know, the more people are playing golf, the better it is. But I just feel like, you know, and there's so many of them, they're doing such a great job, you know, but it's just easy for people to look at, you know, the number and say, well, we have to maximize our tee sheet, which, yeah, I get it. You do, because it's short season, but there's no, you know, you're not busy 24/7, right?
Right.
So, yeah. So, I mean, I just think, you know, acquiring and keeping, and coaches have something to do with that too. If we make it a little easier for players, right, to play well, you know, without making things super complicated.
Do you think that's a key thing? You say that for coaches. I mean, you know, again, sorry, I added one more question here, but, you know, for coaches, I mean, do they have to really focus on, you know, we mentioned about being too technical, maybe a little bit as far as, you know, high tech equipment and stuff like that, but, you know, to emphasize that fun factor as well, and to make them realize that, you know, although they might be serious about it, it's not a job. They may be focused on what they're trying to do and they may be serious about it, but they obviously have to enjoy it still.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. So somebody new to the game was, you know, who's a friend of a friend who was asking me for advice, and she needed some clubs. First question I asked her, like, well, are you planning on walking or, you know, taking carts? And she said, well, walking. And, you know, there's not a lot of beginner clubs that have carry bags,
yeah,
right? So, you know, for instance. And I feel like, yeah, I feel like for, you know, the first lessons I gave were ladies clinics that, you know, I think they were $30 for a clinic, and you got to play 9 holes after. And people loved them because, and I say $30, I don't think it was 30. I think it's probably $20-25. But anyways, you know, I feel like there's little things you can do to make it fun for people, you know, give them something simple to work on, include golf with it. And, you know, then everybody wins, right? Yeah. So I don't think, I do feel like, on a negative note, I do feel like there's a lot of coaches out there who are just trying to put cool stuff on Instagram, mm-hmm. you know, and talk about stuff that is super complicated. Yeah. And it's such a small market that cares about that stuff.
Right.
Yeah. Right. So, you know, I think we have to be careful about that and just, you know, find ways to help people. People get self-conscious when they're golfing, that their technique's not good, that they're not playing as well as their friends, things like that. And if we can make them feel more comfortable on the golf course, I think that's, you know, super important for us to do.
That's a beautiful note to end on. I 100% agree with that. And I really appreciate you coming on to talk with us on Tee Talk. Continued success. Good luck with the rest of your quarantine, and good luck with the rest of the season as well.
Got you. Good work. Thank you very much.
Thank you so very much to Ralph Bauer for that interview. Certainly appreciate it. I hope you did too. Lots of great things that you can learn from Ralph. And, you know, it's always interesting to see kind of a different side of the tour. We see what we see on TV and, you know, a lot of discussion about some of the coaches, but there's a lot more coaches, a lot more people out there. So for Ralph to be able to come and share that with us, I think it's a great opportunity, and I hope you learned something from that. All right, just a few quick things to get to today before we get onto the mailbag and onto the tip of the week. Like I said, don't want to keep you too long. Don't want to have too many opinions of just my own, but just a couple things to mention. The LPGA is set to return soon. The Drive On Championships scheduled to happen in Ohio. I guess it'll be next week now. Interesting field. They're already down to in the 500 range as far as priority ranking for the 135 player field. I think Tita Beck is the last player in the field at this point. Alina Sharp is the only Canadian in the field for the first event. Brooke Henderson is not entered in the first two events. And as we mentioned previously on this show, we are expecting certain numbers of players just not to play, not to feel safe, or to have some other reasons for not coming back and playing. And as of this recording for this podcast, Brooke Henderson is not entered in the first two events of the year. And she did mention to us, I guess back about mid-June that she would be interested in playing, but she hadn't made a decision at that point, and she said she wasn't going to play until she felt safe. So there's that. The second event of the year, also happening in Ohio, we'll also see Elena Sharp in the field, and Canadian Jacqueline Lee is in the field as well. Jacqueline from Calgary, so she'll be in that one, so something to keep an eye on. Symetra Tour, it returns this week. As this podcast comes out, they'll be playing the Fire Keepers Championship in Michigan, so that's nice to see that back. They have a shortened schedule this year, just 10 events. They had one event before the break, so they've got 9 left to finish there. Other mentions, PJ Tour, obviously the 3M Open in the Twin Cities in Minnesota. Not a huge field this week, but should be interesting. Matt Wolf won there, many of you are aware, last year in 2019, got his first win. Most interesting story of the week, I think, so far is the fact that Aaron Crawford, who's a previous guest on the show just over a year ago, was a player who had McKenzie Tour status, PGA Tour Latino America status, but basically was just surviving, getting out there and caddying. And he's been a regular caddy for Martin Trainer, another guy who's been a regular guest on this podcast. And he went out and shot 63 and Monday qualified. So this is his first PGA Tour event after 8 years as a professional. So we wish Aaron the best in Minnesota, and hopefully we can catch up with him soon. Aaron Cockrell, another Canadian, is back in action as well over in Europe. Again, another past guest on the show. I know I keep consistently saying that, but certainly after 74 episodes, this one being the 75th, we've definitely dipped into the player market, especially in the Canadians over the years, over the year and a half as guests. So good luck to Aaron. He's off to a fast start over in England at the British Masters. That's a start of 6 events in the UK for the European Tour. So they've got a little bit of a closed sort of environment, an opportunity for those players to get 6 events in and feel somewhat safe before they move on to some other things that are maybe a little bit more abroad. Okay, well, thanks everyone for that. We're going to get on now to the mailbag. We'll take a little break and we'll come back, hit the mailbag, give you the tip of the week, and we'll wrap up the show, episode 75. This episode of Tee Talk is brought to you by TaylorMade and the all-new Sim Driver. This year, TaylorMade wanted to find golfers more speed and forgiveness in any way, shape, or form. Well, shape one. So they went and changed the driver head, which allowed them to make it both fast and forgiving where you need it, the downswing. It's called Sim, and TaylorMade's tour players are loving it. But the real reason they changed the shape was to help make all golfers better. The all-new Sim Driver. Visit TaylorMadeGolf.ca to learn more about the all-new Sim family. All right, let's get to the mailbag this week. Just my opinions, of course, because obviously Stefan is not here, but I'll answer them as best I can. Let's get started. What will I notice with new wedges in how my shots perform? So first off, obviously people want to make sure that their wedges are as fresh as possible, as often as possible, whatever you can afford, of course. If you're a good player, you want to have as much control with those wedges as possible. And that really means that as wedges wear down on the face, we have a reduced amount of friction. We can't stop the ball as much on the greens after they land, and then also we end up with a higher launch angle as well. So we want to really monitor that, make sure that if we get a wedge that's showing a lot of wear on the face, we try to replace that if we can. And usually if we practice a lot with those clubs, that'll mean replacing them faster than, say, irons, for an example. So what you're going to notice, obviously, then is just the opposite of that. When you get a new set of wedges, a fresh set of wedges, one of the first things that you'll notice is that your spin level will increase a little bit. So you're going to have a little bit more grab around the greens. You'll probably see the golf ball will not roll out as much on your shot. So that's something that you'll have to factor in. Also, as well, because there is a little bit more friction there, it's basically going to grab the ball in a different way, tip down the club head a little bit, and you're also going to see shots take off a little bit lower. So be prepared to see a little bit lower ball flight from new wedges as well. So just practice with them. You'll get used to it pretty quickly. And I certainly think the performance will be better. You just need to adapt a little bit, basically, depending on how bad your wedges were previously. Okay, number two here. I play a lot of golf by myself. Anything I can do to help simulate competition? Well, lots of things that you can do. And obviously, you know, nothing is going to simulate competition except for competition. But you can try to do some different things. One things I try to do with my students a little bit is to get them to play a match. And they're not necessarily going to play a match against someone else. They can play a match against a simulated competitor. So what I'll do is I'll give them a scorecard and I'll fill in the scorecard for the round, and this is their opponent's score, and I'll put in various numbers across the board, and they have to play a match against that person. A lot easier maybe than having them pitted against another student or myself, where they can maybe get a little bit more emotional about it. This basically gives them a target, what they have to go after. It's not necessarily just a stroke score, but it's a match play score, so they have to get into the mode there where they know exactly what they have to beat if they're going to win the hole. So that gives them a target to go at. So that I would give that a try. That's a fun way to go about it. All right, number three here. This is one we get on occasion. Don't see it too much very often, but animal head covers or nah? I mean, I guess this is a younger person that sent this in, but you know what? It doesn't really matter. I mean, whatever makes you happy. Obviously, animal head covers came into vogue probably in the 1990s. They really kind of peaked. Whatever you want to put on your golf bag. I mean, it's your personal style. It's your golf bag. It's whatever you want to have in there. So I don't really have an opinion on this except for the fact that, hey, if you like it and you want to have it in your golf bag, have at it. Number four, what makes the new Nicholas Mura irons worth $2,750 US? All right. If for those not familiar, Mura Golf, which is a Japanese golf manufacturer, now basically operated by a company in the United States, 8AM Golf. They have a relationship with Jack Nicklaus. Now they formalized a relationship to create a commemorative set of irons with Jack Nicklaus. He's going to do the design. These are basically to Jack Nicklaus's specs. You can get them custom made as well. The pre-orders are being taken now, and you can, I think delivery is first quarter 2021. The big thing here is that, first of all, Mura makes high quality products. Obviously, you know, a lot of people get into mystical, you know, traits of different products, and there's a certain reputation for them. But, you know, Mura does make great quality irons, very spot on as far as head weights, great craftsmanship. These irons in particular are extra expensive just because it is the collaboration. You're going to see a lot of people jump onto these just because they're more of a collector. They're Jack Nicklaus's look and taste. They've got the Golden Bear stamp on them. They come in a 3 to pitching wedge. You don't see that too often in clubs these days. So really it comes down to the commemorative value. And some of these people are just going to buy these, put them on the wall, get them in Jack Nicklaus's specs, and away they go. I don't know if you're going to see a lot of them in play, but really it comes down to a collector value, and that's really up to the individual. Are they worth $2,750? That's not up for me to say. That's up to the consumer to decide whether they want to spend that money or not, and if they feel that it is justified. All right, last one here. Thoughts on temper tantrums and pro golfers viewing it on TV? Well, a couple of things here. I guess it's professional golf. They are athletes that are trying to perform their best, so obviously they're going to get frustrated. There's a lot of things that are on the line here. I personally don't like to see, you know, the club slams, any, you know, club breaks, stuff like that, just because there are a lot of younger golfers that are watching, just golfers in general, that are influenced by that. And they think that, you know, just by having a temper tantrum after a poor shot, which you're always going to have some poor shots, that maybe that's the way to act. And, you know, I'd rather see a player just kind of suck it up and move on. I understand why it happens. Obviously, there's a little bit of frustration there for those players. Doesn't look great for those athletes on PGA Tour TV or LPGA Tour TV, although you don't really see a lot, I don't think, as much in the women's game. But those are my basic thoughts on that. Basically, I'd prefer not for it to be happening. And it does happen, but just, you know, make sure if you're guiding a young golfer, make them realize and understand that, you know, just getting upset after a shot doesn't fix it. It's over. It's done. And really, they want to keep calm and get themselves refocused and get ready for the next shot, not let a poor shot affect their next one. All right. Thanks, everybody. That's the mailbag for this week. Please send in your questions. Keep them coming in. Send them in by our Twitter feed. You can send them in by Instagram as well. And we'll get back and answer those every week, as many as we can. All right, our last thing to take care of this week is the tip of the week. And I want to talk to you a little bit about chipping, specifically where you're going to land the ball as you allow it to roll out to the hole. Most people try to fly their chips a little bit too far. As a result of it, they have to take bigger swings with whatever club they're doing, usually with a little bit more loft. And they have a lot of difficulty having consistency. So here's the thing. You want to land the ball just onto the green and let it roll out. You might end up having to use a club with a little less loft than you normally do. But here's a good way to practice it. And it's also a good way to see as well how this is much easier to do. And I've seen this out on tour. Gareth Rafalski does this with Michael Gligic. I've seen him do it with some of his LPGA players as well. What he's going to do is set up to hit a chip. Put a golf ball on a tee in the landing spot where you want to land the ball. And basically what you're going to find is that when you have that ball on a tee closer to you, it's a lot easier to hit that than it is if that ball was on the tee closer to the hole. So that's going to give you a lot more consistency as far as hitting your landing spot and then letting the golf ball roll out. So I think that's a good drill, a good way to do it. Practice doing your chipping with a landing target closer to you. Let the ball roll out a little bit more. I think you'll find a little bit more consistency as far as your strike is concerned, how consistent you're going to be as far as getting the ball close to the hole rather than some that look really spectacular and getting really close and then other ones that are not close at all. So consistency is the key there. Just picking out a proper landing spot, training yourself to hit that landing spot and letting the golf ball roll out to the hole. Well, that wraps up episode 75 of the Flagstick.com Tee Talk podcast. Really appreciate everyone tuning in to listen. Hopefully, Stefan Tiedorf is back next week off his vacation and we can have a wider and deeper discussion about the world of golf. Thanks as well to Ralph Bauer for guesting on the show this week. I hope you really enjoyed that interview. Give him a follow on his social media channels. I'm sure he'd appreciate that. And give us a follow on ours as well. Great way to interact with us and also pass on your mailbag questions. And if you can, please leave a review on whatever site that you listen to this podcast on. Thanks as well to TaylorMade for the continued support of the podcast, this episode specifically. And we look forward to talking to you again next week. Like today, my boat's lost in the ocean.